All right, our scripture reading for today is found in the Gospel according to Luke. We'll be looking at chapter 6, verses 27 through 38. But I say to you, listen, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those for whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. The word of the Lord. Please be seated. I'm coming down because I have a question for you. And we'll start with a show of hands, though you see me doing this, which might reduce your show of hands. How many of you would have thought about what you would do if you won the lottery? Okay, all right. I'm coming for it. Okay, all right. So, let's see. Right. Of course. You know, I'm not going to pretend like I haven't thought about it. In fact, you know, there are times when my kids are little, you know, the machines at the grocery store, the, you know, you put the dollar in, you get the tickets. They would always ask about that. And I would let them play. I would give them a dollar because I wanted to teach them two things. I wanted to teach them, one, I never wanted them to not have hope, you know, that something good can happen. But I also wanted to teach them that that's not the way to make a lot of money. You know, that because, of course, they would lose mostly. It was the worst when they won like $2, you know, because I'm like, okay, now you got to decide what to do with your winning dollar. I mean, we're down over the course of time, probably 35, you know, but you've won now this time. And but you think about what would you do? And I'd have that conversation with my kids, like, what would you do if you win the lottery? You know, when you're a kid, you're not thinking about a vacation. Usually we're thinking about getting away, right? You know, like we want to get away from our regular life. Usually they're talking about something like they want to buy an amusement park. You know, like that's something they want to do and put it into, you know, our backyard or something like that. You know, to think about what would happen if we all of a sudden had this windfall. It was something that always captured my imagination of what would happen. How would my life change if I had a windfall of money? It was because of this that the New York Times captured my attention this week. It was an article that the New York Times had interviewed people who had experienced windfalls. They had either won the lottery, maybe they had gotten insurance payouts, whatever the situation was, what happens when somebody gets a windfall? And of course, some were there. A lot of them were similar. We went on vacation or paid off a house or we blew it within a year or some opened up a 401k. It all depends on your perspective of your life. The one that struck me the most and that I wanted to share with you was a guy named Sean Strub. It's 1985. Sean Strub was diagnosed with AIDS. Now, it's 1985. In 1985, if you are diagnosed with AIDS, that is a death sentence. You are watching people that you know and that you love suffer and pass from this horrible, horrible disease. Sean was declining rapidly, and within a year, he realized that his time was extraordinarily short. In the late 1980s, insurance companies were promoting what was called a viatical settlement. And what a viatical settlement was is that if you had a life insurance policy, you could transfer that life insurance policy to someone else who would then pick up again the premiums. But the transfer, you are able to take out more than the cash value, but less than your death benefit. And you would be able to take this settlement if it was clear that your death was imminent and you still wanted to use the money for something. Then that third party would just continue paying the premiums and just as if they had their own insurance policy. Sean did this, and he decided what he wanted to do with this money was to start a magazine for people living with HIV/AIDS. It was called PAWS. And he loved it. And to quote Sean, he said, I wanted to do with the magazine a very professional magazine, something with great photography. I was tired of the information provided to people living with HIV that was invariably cheaply printed on newsprint and not in color. The only places doing slick stuff were drug companies. I was writing about my friends and people that I knew and the community that I felt such a strong part of. I wanted it to be done beautifully. There was probably also some vanity involved because I saw this as a legacy project since I didn't expect to be around much longer. So he started this magazine and loved it. He was, of course, still ill until they started putting out a different therapy. It was a combination drug therapy, and Sean was one of the early takers of this new drug therapy, this new combo drug therapy. And he started to get a little better. And he started planning, instead of his death being imminent, he thought, well, maybe I have another year. Maybe I have another two. 10 years later, he started to realize that his planning window was starting to expand. Now he wasn't thinking about death being imminent, but thinking that he might be around for a while. By the year 2000, he realized it was going to be more than a few years. And he started to think long term about his life. He had no nest egg, no IRA, but now he wanted to consider what life might be like if he lived for the next 20 or 30 years. In 2004, he decided that he needed to sell Paz magazine and he sold it to a publishing company. And Paz is still being published. It still provides meaningful information to people living with HIV/AIDS. And he said he misses the magazine, but he does have his little nest egg, and the long view changed his life. Being able to realize that his life was longer than he thought changed how he spent his money. You know, we often see it happening the other way. People who think that they've got all the time in the world and are confronted with their own mortality also find a change in life, how they spend their time, because our relationship with time affects how we invest that time. You know, I always hear people go, oh, I don't have time, or I've got all the time in the world. You know, we deal with time. Time is just something that we've made up, some way to mark the moment in which we live our lives. But we all have the same amount of time. All of us, whether the rich, the poor, wherever we live in the world, we all are given the same exact amount of time. It's about how we invest our time that tells us about ourselves and what we pull out of it. In our first reading, Alexis read about Joseph. And I don't know how familiar you are with the Joseph story. Maybe all you know is his Technicolor dream coat, and that's about as far as you got. Joseph's life just started in the whole Technicolor dream coat world. And you look at his life and go, this is a guy that seems to be hitting obstacle after obstacle. He's the favorite of his father, and as a result, his brothers are jealous, and that's where that dream coat came from, is because his father made him this beautiful coat. His brothers decide maybe they'll have him killed, but instead they throw him in a hole, and which is, that's no fun, and go back and tell dad, oh, you know, it looks like Joseph is dead. And then instead of just leaving him in the hole, they see a caravan coming and go, well, let's make some money off of him and sell him into slavery. And he gets into slavery, he's sold into a house, and he's doing okay as the slave in this house, and then gets into an incident of being falsely accused of something and ends up in prison. And then as he's in prison, he's hanging out with some guys and he's able to help them. One of the guys at least get out of prison by just listening to the voice of God and said, please remember me. And of course the guy doesn't remember him. And he stays in prison just languishing there for a while until finally he does get remembered and goes to interpret a dream for Pharaoh. And the interpretation of that dream lands him in this position of power and wealth that you heard today, where when famine happened and his family got to come back, they found that the person that they had to confront was not some kind of Egyptian pharaoh or Egyptian officer, but it was the very brother that they had betrayed and left behind. I thought about Joseph's life, and it's a great story, but Joseph didn't have the end of the story in his pocket when he was going through all of that stuff. And I think, how many times would I have been just cut off from the knees and I would have just quit? I may have quit at the pit. You know, just go, you threw me in a hole. I'm done. Like, God has left me. I am over this. And then you add being sold into slavery, and I'm like, listen, I am so over this. I'm getting the clear message from God that God is not into me. And then I go, and then I'm falsely accused. I end up in prison. I'm like, do I need any more evidence that God is against me? But the thing about Joseph is that Joseph had a long-term view of the faithfulness of God. And so no matter what he experienced, that long-term view carried him through and allowed him to navigate the short-term complexities because he believed in the long-term blessing. And certainly he received it. Last Sunday's sermon was on the Beatitudes, and our Sunday school children are learning about them today. You ever really take time with the Beatitudes, the upside-down wisdom of the Beatitudes? They don't make sense. How can the poor be rich? How can the sad be glad? How can these people that are living in meekness and mildness and poverty be the ones that the passage calls blessed, which could also be translated as happy? These are happy people. Well, I'll tell you why. It's because they are people who are able to have the long view. Think about what our perspective of our cosmos would be if the telescope had never been invented. The telescope is probably the greatest understanding that we have to who we are in relationship to the rest of the universe around us, because scientists can see out to the farthest reaches of the observable universe. They can see the background radiations that are light running from the origins of things. We realize that we're not on this planet held up by Atlas's shoulders or on top of a stack of turtles. But we have a long view that we are in this expanding universe that we have not begun to explore, because being given a long view affects our science, our philosophy, and our theology. For the followers of Christ, the long view matters. I just read the passage out of Luke. And as I read that passage, I don't know how many of you are going, that just sounds impossible to do. Love your enemies? Bless those who curse you? If someone demands your coat, go, here is my coat, but I've got this really nice shirt. You can have that too. Give to people that are begging for you, who are begging things of you, even though they don't seem to deserve it. Don't judge. Don't condemn. Forgive. You ever realize how illogical forgiveness itself is? Vengeance makes the most sense. Forgiveness, that seems crazy. But in order to do this, that the followers of Christ have to have the long-term view. That's the only way that we're going to be able to truly understand what it is to live in the life of God. This passage is letting God's people know that our long-term view allows us to do extraordinary things like forgive, like praying for enemies, or to give freely. We just did the offering. It takes a long-term trust in the faithfulness of God to pull money out of your wallet and to put it into a plate and send it back there, that you don't know where it's going. It takes that kind of faith. Now, all of these things is because our faith says that the smart investment is a life of faith that results in love. You know, I've spoken of busyness a lot. And busyness is something that haunts our lives. We're thinking about it all the time. I was in Barnes & Noble yesterday. I had some work they had to do, and I knew they had a little coffee shop. I went and sat. And as I walked into Barnes & Noble, I passed two tables. You might have already seen this on Facebook. If you were on Facebook this morning, I took pictures of it. The first table was how to be more productive. How to spend your time, how to really make it for it, how to be successful. And there were book after book after book about how to be the successful person that you want to be. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I looked at a couple books. And then I hit the next table, which was about how to reduce the stress in your life and how to be, you know, calm and to live mindfully. And I thought, that's amazing right there. If only we could pull back and understand what these two tables mean. It means that we may be investing in the wrong places, because success doesn't always equal us doing the things that we are supposed to be doing that fits our lives and who we are. Sometimes the way that we live our life means that we only have a short-term view of things to be able to live in this world, and we don't see anything beyond the life that we're living right now. To be able to stretch our view, to pull out a spiritual telescope, and to see beyond the surface of the planet in which we live, that is a life of faith. The life of faith says that it doesn't make sense what I see around me right now, and so I should be doing these things, and certainly I'm not saying anything against doing wise things. But I think in every decision that we make, in every way that we invest, to ask ourselves the question, am I doing this because I have the long view, or am I doing this because I only have a short view? Is my view of God too small? Because where we spend equals what we value. I mentioned people talking about they don't have all kinds of time, you know, and it's always interesting to me, because it tends to be people with more wealth that talk about the limited amount of time that they have. And sometimes it's not a matter of time, but a matter of priority and how we budget that time. It has nothing to do with the demands of our world. It has to do with our choices of what we do. This is what I want to encourage you to do this week. I always want to leave you with some homework. I'd love for you to take some time and consider your allocation of time. I do a budget, and probably a lot of you do a family budget, to make sure that, you know, you don't spend too much in one area so that you don't have enough for another area. And part of spending a budget is to do an analysis, and maybe you've done this, that you take all of your spending and you put it into this pie graph so you can actually see where you're spending the most of your money. And that's such an education to be able to go, am I really spending most of my money there? And you go, yeah, like you really are. And so you go, well, because I want to do this, let me pull this back because I only have a set amount of time, right? The answer isn't, well, let me go make more money because I want to do more things there, though that's lovely. It's about reallocating the resources that you have. This is what I want to encourage you to do. I want you to maybe take this week and think about your time, how you spend your time, and just start writing it down in terms of hours, and include the mental space that you spend thinking about this or thinking about that, driving here, doing this, thinking about how you spend your time. And then just take a look at this and ask yourself, what does my investment of time say about what I believe? What I believe about where I am in the cosmos, where I am in my relationship with God, where do I believe I want to bring my family, my children? Family time is an important thing too. Sometimes us saying simply that we are doing things for our children or for our family, we're still sending the wrong message to our children, even though that we're spending all kinds of time doing things for them. It's where are we bringing them? What are we asking of them? What are we wanting them to see? What I don't want you to take away from is that I'm putting more of a burden on you. I think sometimes when we look at it, it's not about, I want you to spend more time coming to church. That's not the message of this. The message of this is that maybe some of us need to fall in love with Jesus again. Maybe we have forgotten that love, that thrill of being filled with the Spirit of God and wanting to be part of the story of God that is happening both within our local church and God's work in the world. Maybe we have gotten afraid. Maybe we have gotten distracted. Maybe we've gotten caught up with what everyone else is doing. But that's why we take that minute. So I want to encourage you to take your temperature, your time temperature this week as we're heading into this Lenten season, just so that you know where you spend your time, and then ask yourself the question, is that what I believe?